It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this half hour is Josh Voorhees, senior writer for the liberal online magazine Slate. Josh also happens to live in Iowa City. He's popped into our Iowa City studio. Great to have you with us. You've been in Iowa City for 6 years. I don't know why we haven't had you in before, but welcome in any case.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Josh, I want to talk specifically about some of the articles you've written recently that go to this very unusual election season. But first of all, a sort of general comment and ask you for your remarks here. It is an unusual campaign, to say the least, mostly because of Donald Trump's unorthodox campaign. What challenges does that pose to you writing about it?
I mean a variety of challenges. I think one of the immediate ones that Donald Trump has kind of – he's come at such an interesting time as journalism has moved more online and as the news cycle has shrunk in such a remarkably way, where you used to have the newspapers came out – not to relitigate all of journalism, but newspaper headlines would come out. They'd set the story. You'd have that afternoon react and then rinse and repeat the next day. In any given day, we might have 6 or 7 news cycles now. It's so short and everyone reacts quicker that you end up with this breathlessness that often kind of pervades the internet. And Donald Trump is both part and parcel of that. And so it's been a challenge to figure out what is worth covering and what is not, and to strike some type of balance and restrainment. But at the same time, when you hear some of the things he says, it's difficult not to overreact to each one.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe it's impossible to overreact, is in the sense that it's each thing he says, I think, deserves often what would normally be an overreaction. But compared to the historic and unnatural and unprecedented things that he often says and does, that the reaction, while it might seem breathless, I think more often than not might actually be responsible.
Mm-hmm. You have this sense as well. You've been through many election cycles. I have as well. And it seems like there's just too much to feast on.
Mm-hmm. He manages to make news, if you want to use that term, I mean, at an hourly basis. It's, I think, what allowed him to rise so quickly in the primary, where he was competing with 15 other people, 16, I guess, if you count Jim Gilmore, although no one really does. And they were running an election from 8 years ago, where they tried to have the one message of the day and control it. And Jeb Bush can roll out an energy plan, and that's going to get stepped on as soon as Donald Trump starts ad-libbing on stage about Ben Carson and whether he's a pedophile. That's impossible not to alter the news cycle so quickly and so swiftly that everything else just gets lost in the shuffle.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the news media have come for a lot of criticism because of all the attention to Trump. You say this is something the news media can't help itself but do.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of it is, if we're being honest, is kind of where the vast majority of media outlets, not Iowa Public Radio, but the rest of us, we're profit-based companies. So we live in a world where readers get direct feedback of the traffic numbers in ways that they didn't. And while at a place like Slate, we don't have an edict or a requirement, we're not paid by traffic, I think I'd be lying if I said I wasn't aware of my traffic. And I think every journalist wants their stories to be read. And I think that pervades into the coverage of Trump. And obviously you see that on cable news as well.
Mm-hmm. Josh Voorhees, my guest this half hour, senior writer for Slate Magazine Online. Let's talk a little bit. I was looking at some of your writing. I love to read your writing, by the way, on Slate, your analysis and your new angles on some of the stories that are covered in the news. You recently wrote about Donald Trump and an issue that has very deep roots, actually to the beginning of Donald Trump's sort of political career near it, the birther issue. The fact that, as you write, Donald Trump's campaign manager, his top surrogates, his vice presidential pick are now all in agreement. The GOP nominee accepts that President Obama was indeed born in the U.S. But you point out in your writing that absent from this list, everybody on his campaign says Donald Trump now acknowledges that President Obama was born in the U.S. in Hawaii. We've not heard it from Donald Trump.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a conscious decision by the man. He makes no secret that he considers it one of his biggest political victories that he played a role in forcing Obama's hand to release his long-term birth certificate back in, what was that, 2011. It's been center to both his ability to argue that he's a tough guy that gets things done, And then I think that it also implicitly and often explicitly is another way to other the sitting president, which feeds into the larger campaign message that he has, which is very much a type of grievance identity politics of us versus them. And he's always defining us in one very specific way. And I'm being, if I'm going to be frank, as white Americans, and he's dividing them as people of color. And you have our first black president, and he's found a way to other him in the most extreme way. And we've seen them. He's backed off specifically talking about it. He says that if I talk about that again, that's all you guys will talk about. But then as a result, he finds slightly more subtle ways to do it, things like questioning Obama's faith or the whole little spiel about how Obama founded ISIS, which on its face is a ridiculous hyperbolic comment, but it's used so clearly to send a message to a certain type of supporters that want to see, they've been primed to see President Obama as something else, as something that's not part of them in America. Mm-hmm. And he's been able to capitalize on that. And so I think that you're seeing right now where his campaign is constantly trying to do this dance where they'll say two different things and that they just trust that their voters will hear the one they want and just discard the other one. Mm-hmm. So if you're a more
because the facts are President Obama was born in Hawaii. There is no evidence to think otherwise. In fact, there is a lot of evidence to think that he was indeed born in Hawaii.
Yeah. There's no question that
So you would think somebody who got it wrong, as Donald Trump did, would not act like this.
Yeah. And so instead, he has his campaign come forward and say, of course, we don't believe that. And that's kind of a nod to your more moderate Republican who says, OK, Donald Trump isn't this extreme guy. He's learned his lesson. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, by him not saying it different, his more extreme supporters, his more fringe people that and still a sizable percentage of them, if you look at the polls, still believe that Obama is foreign born despite all of the evidence. And by not coming out and saying it, he allows two sets of groups to believe two different things about himself, which is his attempt to kind of square the circle that is his more extreme appeal to the right, but then also needing the more moderate Republicans to get on board and ultimately think it's okay to vote for him come mm-hmm. election day.
You're a young writer. I can see you. You're a young writer. But I wonder if we're in a new era of post-facts when it comes to post-factual political reporting, as you just demonstrated. And there are numerous examples in this election cycle where the facts, fact-checking, doesn't seem to matter.
Yeah, it's on the one hand, kind of early on in the campaign, you could make an argument that this was going to be kind of not a golden age by any means, but in past campaigns, it was focused on political gaffes, right? There was 47%. There was, if you want to go back even farther, Hillary Clinton talking about baking cookies. I mean, it's this idea that a gaffe is defined as a politician saying something they believe that they didn't mean to say aloud. And that led to a really weird coverage where everyone was trying to parse out these comments and overstate them in an attempt to create headlines. And then we're in this age now where there's been so much fact-checking in journalism that wasn't there in the past. Everyone from PolitiFact to Washington Post to Slate, a candidate says something and then you'll see the article like, no, actually, that's not the truth. And then here's the details. And you would think that massive amount of fact-checking in journalism would have led to a better conversation, and ultimately it's not what we're seeing, mm-hmm. which is depressing on one hand, but also I think fascinating and something that we're going to have to deal with.
And playing itself in preparation as we head toward the first presidential debates, and Matt Lauer of NBC being panned for his, I guess it was kind of a pre-debate on foreign policy mm-hmm. here, not correcting certain things that were put out there. So I wonder, what are your thoughts about as we head towards this presidential debate? September 26th is the first one. What will it look like? Will we have moderators just putting their hands up and saying, you can say what you want, you won't be corrected?
I think we're going to see more of that than I'm going to be comfortable with. I believe Wallace, who's doing the final one, the Fox News moderator, has said that he's not going to truth squad, I believe was his term, that he was going to that it will fall to the candidates to fact check the other candidate. And that is both if it were to play out like that, it would be refreshing to see Donald Trump say one thing and Hillary Clinton attempt to rebut it with facts and vice versa. But in kind of the partisanship that we're seeing now, and you can see that in media too, where it seems like both parties are playing with their own set of facts, which I'm not quite sure how the debate then will figure any of that one out, in the sense that we saw this in, I believe it was the second debate in Obama-Romney, where it was Candy Crowley fact-checked about at what point did Obama refer to Benghazi as an act of terror. And the response from the right was swift. She came out. She basically ruled in favor of Obama in the middle of this debate. And immediately the Republicans reacted as though that the refs were biased for Obama. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing that even already with the working of the refs with Donald Trump saying the moderators are against me. The debate system is rigged. It's this clear attempt where he's created an out. If things don't go the way he wants to, he can say, I told you this wasn't going to work. They're never going to give me a fair shake, mm-hmm. which is both a very, again, depressing and scary thing he's doing, and in a very crass political sense, a brilliant thing he's doing.
Have you looked into the way that each of the candidates, Hillary Clinton, the more traditional debate prepper here, very high expectations for Hillary Clinton as a debater here, Donald Trump, what have we heard so far about his debate preparation, how he is going at this?
It appears as though he's not doing any, is kind of the word, official word from Trump camp and kind of the unofficial word. It's always dangerous to take what candidates say about their debate prep at face value.
Well, he's lowering expectations if he says that, right?
Yeah. Donald Trump has set the expectations so low where if he stands on stage and simply looks as though relatively traditional and then therefore the talking heads will throw around the words presidential and he wins in that debate if he just kind of looks normal, which is it's a stunningly low bar that he needs to clear. But at the same time, as we saw through what felt like a million primary debates, is that he's not necessarily one to stand there and look like a traditional candidate. He often talks early, loudly, and often, and then he gets quiet a little bit, and then he comes back. I don't think he'll have the opportunity to disappear on stage the way he did during some of those Republican debates with so many people. Ultimately, it's a long commercial-free atmosphere where him and Hillary will be going back and forth, and I think that that's going to pose a challenge for him. Mm-hmm. Whether he can spin it at the end, we'll see.
In the context of this fact-checking and the debates and so forth, more broadly, comment on traditional journalism. I don't know if you were trained this way, but in terms of objectivity, the desire to deliver all perspectives and perhaps the reader decides, the listener in the case of Iowa Public Radio, to be balanced. Does that serve us well in this time, in this election, I guess, to be more precise?
I think that there's an inherent danger of if you're striving for the – it depends if you're striving for objectivity or if you're striving for the appearance of objectivity. If you – the traditional newspaper reporting, this voice of God, New York Timesian style, right, they're – their quest is to leave no doubt that they're just trying to call things as they see them. They have no political – I don't really have a political bias. They have no political opinion, which I think that there's value for that. But I think that you need to round that out in other ways. I think we've seen a lot of that this general election as the media is both attempting to seem objective. Also, the media has inherent incentive for a close race, both in traffic and viewership, but also because if you're spending all day covering something, you want it to be exciting. It's the boys on the bus system, just where none of us are on the bus and we're all walking from home, but it's still the same idea. And I think we've gotten into some of this coverage where you'll see this kind of false equivalency between everything gets branded a scandal. It's the Trump Foundation scandal and the Clinton Foundation scandal. And like those are two very different things with a very different set of questions, but ultimately they're thrust together. And then we see a narrative that says Donald Trump is dangerous, but Hillary Clinton isn't trustworthy. And then somehow that those two things are the same, that, OK, they're both flawed candidates, moving on. Where obviously, if you read my writing, I personally think that Donald Trump is a significantly more flawed candidate and a significantly more dangerous candidate. And I think that whether you want to call that my opinion, I think that is definitely fair. It is an opinion I'm putting forward, but I'm obviously trying to back it up with as much information and facts as I can. And so I think that that's necessary, that for a reporter to hide their view is less objective than being honest.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the New York Times approach, encapsulated that. What would you say is Slate's approach, your approach to the news and in terms of politics?
Well, generally, the kind of the Slate political team, we're kind of all over the place. We have some pretty strong conservatives, and we have, I would say more than not, we have left-leaning reporters and journalists. And I don't know if that was always the case as much as this election, at least for me personally, feels like it's forcing our hand in a way. Slate started as a very counterintuitive place where we'd be making an argument that perhaps we were playing devil's advocate to balance the scales a little bit, or perhaps we thought a specific subject people were just looking at the wrong way, and we wanted to be like, hey, wait a minute, let's hear this out. And I think that that's still kind of the ethos and the heart of Slate, is to be surprising and to be new and say, hey, wait a minute, what if we look at it from this way? And I think we have that luxury because as an online magazine, we're not a newspaper of record. We can kind of pick and choose our spots where, as much as I will be critical of the New York Times, they fill a very different role. They need to cover everything. And I think that will – there's a kind of a give and take between that.
Mm-hmm. To get at it perhaps in a different way, what do you see when you envision your audience? Who are you talking to? What are you trying to – what type of person are you trying to appeal to?
That's a question that we grapple with kind of every day in a very general sense. Are we trying to – convert people to our viewpoint? Or are we trying to preach? Not that you ever want to preach to the choir, but also you want your team, for lack of a better term, to have the information that they need and they want. So I think that there's a balance there. I don't know if I've always hit the right one this year. Trump is very difficult. For me, I think it's very important to find a way to separate my feelings about Donald Trump and how he is dangerous, and not necessarily force my opinion of Donald Trump onto your typical Donald Trump voter, because those are different people, and Donald Trump might be playing on certain things unfairly, I think, often. But there's a reason that such a large swath of the country has been receptive to his message.
Right here in Iowa. Iowa is a swing state, not many electoral votes, but a swing state, no doubt. It's neck and neck there. Do you here in Iowa, living here in Iowa, seek out Donald Trump supporters because you write also so critically about Donald Trump to listen to them?
In my professional life, I certainly do. In my personal life, I try to get that little respite and not talk politics at the dinner table necessarily, just because it's obviously it can be a frustrating conversation, I think, for both sides to have. It doesn't mean we shouldn't have it. It just means you need to constantly remind yourself, and I think that this goes on both ways, and it might even sound a little bit like a platitude, but I think it is important to understand that the people have their own reasons for reaching their conclusions, and it's not necessarily the reason you want to assign to them. I think online journalism exacerbates this problem more than anywhere, but it's always there in politics, and you don't want to find a straw man to argue against. You want to find the person to argue against, and I just think the problem this year is Donald Trump is often a living embodiment of a straw man, where he takes the most extreme and most often weakly reasoned arguments, which are normally the ones you want to avoid with doing. You don't want to engage with those. You want to find the smart conservative and engage with them. But Donald Trump is the Republican nominee, and therefore he's the standard bearer of the party.
But his arguments won him the primary and have a chance of winning him the White House.
True. Very true. And it's something that I think we need to reckon with more fully, whether he wins or loses. If Donald Trump loses in November, I'm afraid that the country will too quickly just say, okay, well, that's over. But he got the votes. I mean, people stand and cheer at his rallies. While I think he is stoking some of this sentiment, some of the xenophobic and racist and misogynistic sentiment that we see out there, Donald Trump did not create it. It was there at the beginning, and he merely is speaking to it. And I think that that's a reckoning that the Republican Party in specific needs to come to, but I think it's also one that the Democratic Party needs to come to and really engage with as well.
You write a weekly guide to the polls, Josh, for Slate magazine. What are you seeing currently? We saw a slight correction, if you want to call it, if this was a stock market, where Donald Trump gained a little bit, of course, in the aggregation of polls that people watch.
I think There was this tightening that happened maybe about a week or two ago that we just kind of saw last week for the first time. And it seems like it may have stalled right now a little bit. But coming out of the conventions, Hillary was enjoying a pretty sizable post-convention bump, as candidates tend to do. And at the same time, Donald Trump was I often refer to it as a self-created controversy tour. He just – every 3 days he had some new controversy that he seemed to be extending or creating himself, whether it was going toe-to-toe with the Khan family, whether it was joking, if you want to call it, about the Second Amendment people and what they might do to stop Hillary Clinton.
But now he's under new management. Have you noticed the difference?
Yes, and it was interesting because he brought in kind of one big hire that got all the news, which was Steve Bannon of Breitbart News, who is a pretty far-right, blustery type guy. And everyone thought, okay, he's going to let Trump be the best/worst version of Trump, where he's saying everything at his head. But then he also brought in Kellyanne Conway, who's a little bit more of a restrained pollster and messenger. And they've managed to strike an interesting balance where Trump is still doing the Trumpian things, but then when he sits down with CNN, he looks a little bit more polished. And they had the stunt where they went to Mexico to give him this diplomatic air. And I think that that's playing a role in the polls. But I also think we were at a point where Donald Trump couldn't have been lower. So we're almost seeing just a correction to that more than anything else. We're obviously have an interesting week now after kind of the mini health scare of Hillary and then the basket of deplorables comment.
I wonder if you think it's a little bit like the stock market. And we know when the market goes up or down and then the people in the markets then explain why it went up or down because, well, really they have to have a reason, right? Because they're pundits, right? Mm-hmm. Does the same thing happen in politics?
Oh, I mean, definitely.
Make up something.
Yeah. We're constantly looking for direct causes, and we don't know. It's impossible to know what's changing the views. We don't know what information each voter has. Some are informed in voting how you think that they would for their own interests. Some are informed in voting against what you think their best interest would be. And voters are people. They're difficult to understand. And I think we're often looking for this oversimplification of this is the reason for this. But generally speaking, I think if you take at least a medium view and one half step back, if you look at it, the race is a little bit tighter than it was. Hillary Clinton still has an advantage, by no means a lock. And that's kind of where things were before the conventions and where they are now. So it feels like this might be kind of where things would normally be, barring a surprise. But if I'm back here next week and the polls have changed, I'll make up a new reason and tell you that.
Josh Voorhees, we hope to have you back again. We've run out of time. Thank you very much for coming into our studio today. We'll look forward to seeing you, more of your writing. Senior writer for Slate Online, Josh Voorhees, also a resident of Iowa City for many years. Josh, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up after a short break, you've probably used Airbnb while traveling. That's this marketplace online for people to list and rent vacation homes and rooms. Perhaps you're a host or you've been a guest. Join our conversation. We're going to talk about how Iowa communities are reacting to the sudden growth of Airbnb when we come back. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back midstream.